what's up, all of you crony capitalists out there? Welcome to the latest edition of the Sons of History podcast. We've got a great show lined up for you. One of our very special guests is a man by the name of Alan Joaquin.
I must take exception to your crony capitalism. We are not crony capitalists. We are free market capitalists. So, there. And I've got the books to prove it. So there you go.
What's the difference? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to find out. We're going to find out what the difference is with Thomas DiLorenzo, one of the more prominent economists, especially free market economists, roaming the countryside in the modern era today. He's just a great guy. He's put out a ton of work, and it's a freaking honor to have him on the show.
I'm looking forward to the discussion in terms of because I know that he's with that Austrian school of economics. And, you and I, we've talked about Adam Smith, who's with the classical school of economics. And we've spoken about Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. So I think this should be a pretty fun conversation.
I think it will clear up a lot of things for a lot of people. Maybe help people maybe see things in a different light. Maybe they'll, you know, look, there are some people who are going to be stuck in their perspective ways. Like it that's fine. If you're, you know, you're not a big free market person, or you are a big free market person, it's just, this is going to be a conversation with somebody who is incredibly knowledgeable about economics, has written extensively about it, teaches extensively about it. And speaking of being extensive about something, can you subscribe to our YouTube channel, ladies and gentlemen? If you haven't yet, please do. Also on our podcast, wherever you're listening, do us a favor and subscribe. Maybe share it with your friends and family, your loved ones. They're good people. They need to know what's going on in the world of history. Along with that, social media, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. That's right. We're on Twitter. We got on Twitter when Elon Musk made his vow to clean her up. And boy, has he been doing that. Alan, I know you're a big fan, and you were correct. I posted that video the other day. You were right. I was wrong. Elon officially has taken over Twitter.
Ha! And I'm not done. There's still a lot more predictions that I have for things in general.
I'm sure. And it's like I said the other day, I forgot who was on the show. I said, look, whenever I question Alan on something, I know I am probably going to be wrong. Now, I did put the caveat that that's typically about historical stuff and typically not about the future. But you've got a pretty good track record on things to be. So, ladies and gentlemen, as well, you can visit us on thesonsofhistory.com. Go check out all of our gear that we offer up. Alan, before we really get into it, I did want to bring this up because this has got a lot to do with our conversation that we're going to be having with Tom. Crony capitalism and how governments and big corporations work hand in hand and everything. We've got an article that recently came out. It's preposterous. It came out in the Atlantic the other day. It's been making the rounds and really pissing people off, me included, probably you too. And it's entitled, Let's Declare a Pandemic Amnesty. Have you come across that yet?
I have. And in fact, I've also seen a lot of memes. One of them was the burned witches were told afterwards, hey, you know what? We made a mistake. Let's have a little bit of an amnesty here for some of the mistakes we made.
Yeah, there were mistakes on both sides. I think that was the cartoon, yeah.
I think it was. And I want to see what it is that they want to do. Are they just wanting to wash their hands and say, okay, let's just move on? No. There are a lot of people who became very wealthy. I want to see the people that pushed these vaccines, because there was a singer who just died today. He was 35 years old. And how many people just since our last broadcast, there have been quite a few young people who just died heart attacks, even some ladies, although I wouldn't call this one person a lady, that 49-year-old woman that was enjoying watching, or actually she made comments about people who refused the vaccine should be punished in some way, and she suddenly died of a heart attack, I hear. So, but not only that, but the number of people who have lost their businesses, you can't get that back.
Yeah.
In friendships, relationships, jobs that have been lost, you can't get any of them back.
Like millions of people that were just coming out of poverty were driven back into poverty. You had so many children traumatized and their education go backwards. Now, what was it? The CDC had to update like the requirements, educational requirements for young children because of what happened with the pandemic and the lockdowns and everything, trampled on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, just overtly trampled on it. There's a lot of covertly trampling on the Constitution, like with agencies and bad decisions from the courts and bad bills written by the legislature and bad executive orders. We get that. But what has taken place with this pandemic and to ask for amnesty? I mean, that's right up with totalitarian states that destroy families and kill people, because a lot of people have died from reactions to these vaccines and everything. And I know this may knock us off of YouTube or whatever, that would suck, but there's a lot of ramifications that have taken place that all of a sudden people, I just thought the nerve of this person to write this article and the nerve of the Atlantic editorial board to go ahead and put this out there to ask for amnesty and say, look, mistakes were made. Are you kidding me? Lives were destroyed. We know people whose lives were destroyed because of the lockdowns. You had a friend who, his mother like threw herself off of a balcony?
No, a friend of mine in Miami, she, because of the lockdowns, was not allowed to see her granddaughter. And I mean, she was my age too. And this happened a few years, 2 years ago, I think. And she was so depressed. She was hanging out with her brother, who was also a friend of mine, and she jumped off a 20-story balcony. You can't get her back.
No. You can't get those things back that were lost. I mean, like you said, family ties were destroyed because there was such massive propaganda on this entire pandemic. Started from the beginning, and it is, like I said, it's preposterous to even submit that type of article. But yeah, I wanted to get your thoughts on it. It's just an amnesty. No,
you know, it reminded me of when Khrushchev of the Soviet Union apologized for what Stalin had done, what the communists had done to millions of lives. Yet they kept their power. They did not say, you know what, we know we really screwed up, and so we're going to make amends. Nope, they just said, we're sorry, let's take down, you know, Stalin's statues, but we're going to stay in power.
Yeah, nothing will change. It's like, look, buddy, an apology is not going to work. I will tell you what will work even less, and that is a demand for amnesty. No, people have to be held accountable for what took place. Will that happen? Unfortunately, no. It won't happen. Maybe there'll be a few fall guys, but the powerful, as they say, the rich just get richer, and boy, did they get richer during this pandemic. Greatest transfer of wealth in human history took place during the pandemic, but whatever, man. You know, you had politicians, congressmen, and senators utilizing the pandemic for insider trading. And who's being held accountable? No one. None of them are being held accountable, Republicans and Democrats. None of them. And that's the world we live in. And that's why we're talking about crony capitalism. That's why we are living in that's part of our economic system right now.
I'm gonna ask him about Fauci, and you know, he still has his millions. He's still, my understanding is that he is he's on the board of directors with Moderna, or he's got a patent with Moderna. I'm not exactly sure, or he's a major stakeholder in Moderna. But okay, does he get to keep his millions? What about, you know, the Governor Whitmer of Michigan? What about Gavin Newsom of California? Lena Hidalgo of Harris County? Are they, if for some unknown reason they get reelected, at least Whitmer and Hidalgo, are they going to keep their jobs? Because they sure as hell shouldn't.
Yeah. No, they shouldn't. And that should be the least that should take place. This stuff is criminality. Criminal charges should be brought forth. But, ladies and gentlemen, enough with that. We're going to bring our guest on as our new setup is. We're going to do This Week in History and the book and movie recommendation at the end of the show after the conversation. And we've got Thomas DiLorenzo on the show today. He's a former professor of economics over at Loyola University in Maryland. And he's a member of the senior faculty of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He is the author of a number of books. Here's just a few of them: How Capitalism Saved America, Hamilton's Curse, Organized Crime, The Unvarnished Truth About Government, The Problem with Socialism, The Problem with Lincoln, and his latest, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Economics. We've got Thomas DiLorenzo, who is waiting to join us, and we've got him on the line. Tom, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's an honor to have you on here. The work that you have done, the immense amount of work, really precedes itself. And so it's a huge honor to have you on. Thanks for coming on. And obviously, this conversation is going to be right up your alley. We're going to be talking about economic issues. I wanted to sort of discuss primarily about crony capitalism and how and why Americans are starting to sort of embrace that, maybe even unwittingly. But before we do, you're part of the Austrian School of Economics. Can you tell us what that is and what's the difference between that and maybe the Keynesian school and some other schools?
Yeah, the so-called Austrian School of Economics is called that because it was founded by a man from Austria named Karl Menger in the late 19th century. And his after him came Ludwig von Mises, who was also Austrian. And the Mises Institute, that's M-I-S-E-S, Institute in Auburn, Alabama, is sort of the epicenter of scholarship of Austrian economics. And your listeners can look at the website, Mises.org, and find out all about it. And it studies economics as human action, human behavior, and it uses economic theory and methodology to understand human behavior. And it does, it's kind of different than mainstream economics, which is much more interested in mathematical modeling that is usually far detached from reality, which is why, for example, after the crash of 08, you had a lot of the big shot Nobel Prize winning economists from the University of Chicago writing articles apologizing in the Wall Street Journal for not having, for being clueless about this. But the Austrians weren't, they had predicted it. And so it's the biggest free market school of thought in the field of economics.
Now, where does Adam Smith come in? Because obviously, he's not Austrian; he's classical. So,
well, sure. Well, a lot of the Austrian economics, like other schools, build on people who came before. So there's not a clear. It's not like the Democrats and the Republicans. It's not a clear-cut point of demarcation between these schools of thoughts. The Austrians and the Chicago School, so-called, and even the Keynesians probably agree on most things regarding supply and demand and the basics about economics. But the so-called Keynesian economics is really a version of central planning. It looks at economics as a tool to be used to advise politicians on how to manage our lives. Whereas the Austrians are more interested in just understanding how the economic world works and talking about how you and I and everybody else can have as much freedom as possible to pursue making a living, starting a business, and doing well economically, rather than being manipulated like rats in a cage, being experimented upon by politicians. And that's how I've always thought of the so-called Keynesian school, which is really our version, the American version of socialist central planning. We never went as far as the Russians in so-called central planning of our economy, but it's still planning. It's a version of planning. And the Austrians explain why markets work and governments don't. That's sort of the bottom line behind it.
Well, I know that the Keynesian model, I suppose, or the Keynesian economics took off after, if not the First World War, the Second World War, for sure. And I even heard a story that Friedrich Hayek and forgot what Keynes's name was. I know it's John Keynes, and they had met. I think they were both working as air raid wardens or something of that nature. But the Keynesian model kind of took off, and then in the 80s we started. I know Reagan had supply side economics, and Thatcher had she was veered the country United Kingdom into the right. And I remember that they praised Friedrich Hayek. So how, and then you had, Milton Friedman kind of came in. So, I mean, how did European and the American models of economics go from one to the other? Or, I mean, we didn't really embrace Keynesian until, I'm going to say, lately. But, I mean, how would you look at it in terms of the timeline?
Well, it was the Great Depression. Keynes's book, it was called The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. And he was published in 1936. And it was really not economics. It was sort of a half-baked engineering model that rationalized government spending to save us from the Great Depression. And basically saying, if the government takes $1,000 away from you and you allow government bureaucrats to spend it, it'll somehow create more than $1,000 in wealth in the country. And politicians, of course, loved it because it rationalized them being able to portray themselves as the saviors of the world. Although it was a flop from the beginning because the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, which embraced Keynesianism in big spending, deficit spending, and so forth. At the beginning of the Great Depression, the unemployment rate was 2.9%. By 1939, it was still over 17%. 1939, the end of the 1930s. So despite all the massive government spending that John Maynard Keynes and the so-called Keynesians recommended by Roosevelt, he actually made the Great Depression worse, not better, because you have to take taxes out of the pockets of the people to pay for all that spending. So they destroyed a lot more jobs that would have been created in the private sector with massive tax increases than they created by creating government make-work jobs. And the Great Depression really didn't end until World War II was over. World War II did not end the Great Depression because something like 11 million men went to war. So of course, unemployment all but disappeared. There were 5.5 million unemployed people by the late 30s. And 11 million went to war. So of course unemployment ended, but the standard of living declined even more during the war because we had to divert all those resources from the consumer side to the military side of the economy. And it wasn't until the war was over and the government actually cut the budget, federal budget, by two-thirds from 1945 to 1947. And as a result, 1946, the year 1946, was the most prosperous year in all of American history in terms of what we call GDP, gross domestic product growth, in terms of the private section of that. Private consumption spending and private investment spending by businesses grew by 30% in one year, right, which is about 10 times the historical average. So just the opposite of what Keynesianism predicted happened. But the Keynesians just ignored that. And to this day, they ignore that. But the real bust in Keynesianism came, and they predicted that there was a trade-off between inflation and unemployment. They said that if we have high unemployment, a government can just spend wildly. And yes, it might create a little bit of inflation, might create a lot of inflation, but it's worth it if we can put people back to work. Well, when we got to the 1970s, we had what's called stagflation. That is, inflation and unemployment went up at the same time. And that thoroughly discredited Keynesianism. And that's about the time that Milton Friedman wrote his famous book, Free to Choose, with his wife, wife Rose. And they had a PBS series called Free to Choose. It's online. Anybody, I used to use it in my classrooms for many years. I showed students the videos. And so that's sort of a nutshell story. And Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1974. And one of the reasons was he had predicted stagflation years ago. He had explained that this could lead to rising inflation and unemployment. That's one of the reasons he was awarded the Nobel Prize. And then Friedman came later in 1976. He won the Nobel Prize as well. And but politicians, you know, they like to be able to spend other people's money. And so they tend to just ignore that. So today, they invented a brand new theory. They call it modern monetary theory. There's nothing modern about it. It's ancient. And it says the government can just be a legalized counterfeiting machine and print up money with no negative effects. It can print up trillions and trillions of dollars and make us all rich, and there will be no downside. I call it Zimbabwean monetary theory. But even senile old Joe Biden has been mouthing the words of modern monetary theory. They got a couple of academics to write a book or two about this. And it's an attempt to revive this old ancient idea, thoroughly discredited by over the past several centuries, that the government can spend us into prosperity. And the foolishness of that is that it takes work and investment and production to create prosperity, and not the printing of paper by politicians.
See, I've always thought, because there is the argument that, well, Keynesian economics works because look at the boom that we experienced during and after World War II. But in my thought was, well, during World War II, weren't we rationing and everything was only going to just a few industries?
That's what I said. World War II made the standard of living even worse than it was at the end of the Great Depression, because you had all these years, like I said, the unemployment rate was still almost 18% in 1939. So the New Deal was a flop. It made the Great Depression longer lasting and worse, deeper. And so and the standard of living for the average American at home was actually worse in 1944 than it was in 1940. It wasn't until the war ended and the government reduced spending from $97 billion in 1945 to $35 billion in 1947. That's about a two-thirds reduction in government spending. And that's what created the prosperity, the post-war prosperity. And also the fact that Roosevelt was gone and all of his other advisors who had a frenzy of government control and central planning and regulation, they were gone for the most part. And so we had a little spark of freedom that created the prosperity in the post-war years. And what set off that spark was that two-thirds reduction in government spending. Imagine today cutting the federal budget in absolute dollars by two-thirds, how much prosperity that would create. There'd be no poverty or no talk of poverty at all anywhere in America if we were to do that and give the people all that money back and get it out of the greedy hands of politicians and bureaucrats.
So when people make the argument like, well, look at how much money we made during World War II, from my perspective, it's like, well, your clients were nations. It wasn't like companies and individuals. Like these were nations that needed heavy material like ships and tanks and guns and everything. Like, that's where all the money came from. Everything was pointed into the direction of just a few industries. And like, I think people take just the numbers when they look at the numbers and say, well, there was a boom. Like, well, there was a boom because there was a literal boom. It was called a massive world war.
There wasn't a boom. The consumer spending was down during the war. Investment spending was down. Defense contractors made a lot of money, as they always do, but it came at the expense of impoverishing the average taxpayer even more. There's no free lunch, and there's no such thing as a free war either. All of the money that was spent on the war could have been spent on something else, and the same is true with any kind of government spending. The more every $1 billion we throw away in Ukraine is $1 billion that would have been spent here in America. And so it's not, there's no free lunch. No matter what we do spending on the military, you fool yourself in thinking it's good for the economy. It's not. It's good for McDonnell Douglas and Raytheon, you know, good for them, but it comes out of your pocket and my pocket and everybody else's pocket who's a working person and a taxpayer. It's bad for us.
Now, I know after the First World War ended, we had a recession. But after World War II, we didn't. You're saying, and I've read the same thing, that we had quite a boom after the war ended, after the Second World War ended. Now, the argument from the people who support the Keynesian model are going to say, well, now these defense contractors that were getting all this money had to lay everybody off, so that's bad for the economy, so therefore we need to keep them employed. How does that fly with reality?
It does fly with reality. The money that would have been spent on defense will be spent and create jobs somewhere else. And so you might see the fact that Raytheon is laying off some employees, but what you don't see, unless you study basic economics, is that you know that the billions and billions and billions of dollars that are no longer being spent there are being spent and invested by American businesses and by American consumers somewhere else and creating different types of jobs somewhere else. And so that's the reality of it. And so it's a fool's errand to think that we can create jobs by giving handing money over to the government. If it's necessary for a defensive war, that's one thing. But don't fool yourself. You're fooling yourself, and you're being delusional if you think it creates prosperity. It does not. War creates destruction, death, and disaster. And sometimes that's necessary if it's a matter of defending ourselves against aggressors. But don't fool yourself into thinking that that's the same as being prosperous. It's not. It makes you poor.
Now, I had read that during the 50s, when Eisenhower was president, that the top income rate was in the 90s. But the economy was doing very well. I think there might have been a slight recession in 56 or 58. I don't recall which one. But overall, when Kennedy, I know he cut taxes. So the argument that is being made today is that, well, if Eisenhower can have a tax bracket in the 90s, we should keep it that way. The things that I had heard, and maybe you can confirm it, is that there was a lot of I don't know if you want to say loopholes, but unless you didn't do any investment in your business or anything like that, then yes, you had to pay the 90%. But otherwise,
Eisenhower did not have a 90% top tax rate. That was during World War II. The top tax rate was high, but it wasn't 90% when Eisenhower was president. But yes, tax loopholes were the savior of the American economy back in those days, because it kept that much money out of the grasping hands of politicians and bureaucrats and allowed ordinary people to spend it and invest it and live their lives. And so that was the savior. We need more tax loopholes, not fewer. And by the time Reagan became president in 1981, we still had the top tax rate was 70%, but that was the top. you know, the 90% was only for the very wealthiest people in the country. It's not like everybody was paying 90% when President Eisenhower was in office. That's ridiculous. It was just a few people that were caught in that trap. And thank goodness for them that they had loopholes to allow them to escape that trap, because that's slavery, basically. If you have a 90% tax rate, that means you're working 90% of the year, 90% of what you make, you're basically a slave to the government. And then the government says, here, you can keep enough to, so that you don't starve to death. You can keep 10%. And so we ended that kind of tax slavery when Reagan came in. And then the top rate went from 70%. And I believe you had to have an income of over 200,000 at that point. And this is 1980, 81. And I went to 28% is the highest rate. And then the lowest rate, was much lower, of course. But even during Eisenhower, the average middle-class taxpayer paid a much lower tax rate.
So I want to discuss like how this sort of this mindset of crony capitalism has sort of seeped into the American psyche. I mean, turn of the 20th century, there was always like you'll read a lot about how people were against crony capitalism, going against whatever political party to sort of demand that they stop crony capitalism and just benefiting a few people. But I have noticed that people a lot of times are using, I guess, moral value points like safety with the usage of, okay, let's have a massive expenditure for the military. Then there are people who are like, well, we've got to quell hate speech, so we need to get in bed with the communications and the social media industry. And then there are people who are like, okay, what about climate change? And then there's people, we had the pandemic, and like, you need to get vaccinated so that you can protect yourself and other people and you don't kill your grandparents and things like that. But the people that are really benefiting from these pushes are corporations, like massive corporations. You mentioned Raytheon, but we can talk about Pfizer. We can talk about Twitter and everybody else. These are the ones that really benefit. So how is it that the American people, who are supposed to be about freedom and liberty and free speech and everything, continue to get duped into, this is for your benefit, so let's do this, and it really only benefits the major corporations or people at the top or the government?
Yeah, well, I think most Americans hate freedom. I think the majority actually hate and despise freedom. The Americans no longer like the idea of freedom. There's only a minority of us who are championing the cause of a free society. And it's because the government has been in control of the schools for so long, and they teach the children beginning in preschool about the evils and the scariness of the civil society and of corporations and of the benevolence and omniscience of the state of government. That begins in preschool, and so of course by the time you get to the university, orders of magnitude more. And so they've done a very good job in destroying the ideas of the founding generation of America. And so that's point number one I would make. And point number two is most Americans probably don't understand that there's a difference between competition and capitalism, real capitalism, and crony capitalism. Real capitalism is on the television show Shark Tank, where ordinary people come up with an idea for a product or a service, and they're making a pitch for investors to invest their money so that they can expand and produce this product or service for more and more people in the free market. Crony capitalism is the pharmaceutical industry, for example, in the 1980s lobbied the government to make them exempt from liability if somebody becomes ill or dies from one of their vaccines, exempt, so that they're off the hook for liability. And then, as you probably know, to approve all these vaccines, you have to go through this process with the Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control, And the people who are on these regulatory bodies are from the pharmaceutical industry. It's called, economists call it the capture theory of government regulation. Industries have captured all the regulatory government regulatory agencies, and they are run for the benefit of the industry and against the interest of consumers. That's why when it was ludicrous when they voted to include children's vaccines for COVID recently, a 15-0 vote. Every single person, all 15 of them, were on the take, lackeys of the pharmaceutical industry. You know, I played golf a while ago with a couple of Canadians who said, you know, gee, this is the first time in a couple of years we were able to leave our country. And so one of them asked me, why isn't it, do you think, they haven't come up with medicine for COVID? Why do we have to have a vaccine? And the short answer that I gave him was, Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company is not in the medicine business. They're in the vaccine business. And they finance the careers of a lot of politicians in Washington, D.C. That's why. And it's called the revolving door also. A lot of the bureaucrats at the FDA and the CDC will quit their jobs and work for Pfizer and these other companies and make millions of dollars a year, pretty much using their expertise in how to wring money out of the government and out of the taxpayers' pocket, really, for the benefit of these corporations. And so this is a long story. It began at the founding of America, the great debates between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. Jefferson was suspicious of what we would call crony capitalism because they had fought the revolution to escape a system like that. It was called mercantilism in England back in the 1700s. But Hamilton wanted to bring it here to America as long as smart lawyers like himself were in charge, so he thought. And so for several hundred years now, we've gone back and forth over allowing some degree of competition versus some degree of crony capitalism. But in today's world, it seems like the crony capitalists are gaining more and more ground every day. And you know, the whole COVID debacle was a good example of that.
Was the London East India Company that was part of the whole Boston Tea Party, was that would be considered crony capitalism then?
If it was related to government and getting government contracts, you know, yeah, that was.
Yeah, I mean, it very much was. Now, I also.
The whole British system was built on what we today call crony capitalism. They called it mercantilism back then.
Right. So I know Anthony Fauci, he will. He's on the, if I'm not mistaken, he's on either the Moderna board or he has a patent with the. Something to do with COVID or with Moderna. Can you clarify which one? Or
probably corrupt. He's probably the most corrupt person in Washington, and that's saying something.
That's tough to do.
He's been sort of the political water carrier for the pharmaceutical corporations for 40 years, and you saw what happened with the COVID business. You know, you guys probably saw that, you know, there were these doctors all over the world who were treating patients in the early stages of this flu with hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, and they were doing fine. But they banned it. You know, they made it illegal. If you're a doctor, you could lose your license over this. And they're still threatening to withdraw the licenses of doctors who question Anthony Fauci and Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company. And that's really the heavy-handed totalitarianism, not just crony capitalism.
Well, we've already seen that the big tech is working with the government to silence you, just shut you down, cancel you if you said anything negative about them. And I am really, really praying to God that the GOP takes the House and the Senate, because I want to see Senator Rand Paul come up with what really happened, because we don't know. And I know that he wants to find out about who was, you know, these people in the CDC, who's paying them, where are they getting their money? And I know that I'm assuming this all falls under the whole crony capitalism part.
Yeah, he's chomping at the bit to do that. He'll be the chairman of this Senate Health Committee. I forget what the exact name of it is, if the Republicans take the Senate. But you know, the Republicans are good at holding hearings, but then they never do anything about it. And so if they just hold hearings and prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Fauci is a crook and a corrupt, well, so what? Unless he goes to prison, it's all a bunch of hot air, isn't it? And so unless somebody is penalized for this and has paid some kind of punishment, it's just a bunch of more hot air coming out of Washington, D.C. And I'm not saying Rand Paul is probably the best possible person to do this, because he is a medical doctor and a senator, but he has to get the other senators online to actually act and do something. And he's not going to get Biden's Department of Justice, laughingly called to prosecute anybody on this. That'll have to wait to the next presidential election or the one after that, depending on who becomes the next president.
So you had early on, you were talking about how Americans, a lot of them, hate freedom. And it sort of reminded me of Milton Friedman's comment about security or freedom, where if you want security rather than freedom, then you'll get a less percentage of both. But if you choose freedom over security, you'll get a higher percentage of both. But when you're talking about how people were, doctors around the world were using ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, and the government and agencies and the media and social media companies were shutting them down, some losing their jobs, and people didn't want to believe what those people were saying, even though the research was being done and presented. From my perspective, it's less about security over freedom and choosing truth, between truth and freedom, and then choosing neither one. It's like, you know what is being, that becomes, because it's not even security anymore. Like, if somebody's saying this is not good for you, or this is good for you and here is why, and you're not going to listen to both sides because there were both sides saying the vaccine is safe and effective, no harm done. And then there were some that were like, hey, you need to be careful about getting that, especially if you have underlying conditions or different things like that. There were so many people that just didn't care about security, freedom, or truth. It was, I guess, almost to an extent, serfdom. Like, it was Hayek's road to serfdom. People had already been on the road, and so here we are. What is the deal with the modern American society to where you just throw all three of those, I guess, ideals out the window?
Yeah, well, there's a famous old essay called War is the Health of the State by Randolph Bourne. It's spelled B-O-U-R-N-E. You could read it online. And it's related to this. He wrote it during World War I. And he said that when people are faced with something like a war, a lot of people tend to become child-minded. They look for a new mommy and daddy to take care of them, and government becomes the mommy and daddy because they're terrified, they're frightened. And they're, you know, the Nazis want to take over or whoever, and so it's easy, and so they tend to go along with whatever the government wants them to do, whereas a year earlier they would never have done that. They still might have been, you know, saying, well, what about civil liberties and so forth. And I think the same thing happened. The government finally, after all these years, hit upon a way of terrorizing the population without a war. You know, they keep inventing, you know, more and more war, you know, all the time. But in addition to that, now they think they got the magic bullet, terrorized people with a pandemic. At the beginning, you know, they were saying, you know, 3% of the population might die off, something like that. And so you had the same effect where people became child-minded and, you know, mommy, protect me. And mommy was the local government bureaucrat enforcing the shutdowns of all the restaurants, but allowing the liquor stores and Walmart and the grocery stores to stay open, and shutting down all the churches. But you can go and shutting down voting, for that matter. You know, if you went to the grocery store with a mask on for a year, you could have gone to vote with a mask on, couldn't you? But can't do that. And so that was part of it too. But I think Randolph Bourne's old essay explains a lot about why Americans reacted like little children when faced with this pandemic. I personally knew some intelligent working people who were not young, in their late 30s, early 40s. They were hysterical at the beginning of this. They just lost it. I had a man who almost, he was acting like he wanted to punch me out of the grocery store because I was walking the wrong way down the aisle. The arrow said, walk the other way. You probably had people like that that you ran into also. But read that essay, War is the Health of the State. But instead of war, transpose the word pandemic. And a pandemic is the health of the state. And the things that Randolph Bourne says, you'll see, it really explains what happened in the last couple of years.
So I was reading an article on crony capitalism, modern crony capitalism, and it was on the Hoover Institution's website, and they were talking about that, and I was reading some of the comments. I enjoy reading comments because people can come up with some really random stuff. It's pretty entertaining, but somebody put on there fascism, and that word gets thrown around so much, so easily, that it's lost its meaning. But I thought for a second, I was like, because I had done some research on Japan at the turn of the 20th century and how they were funneling more or less all and everybody towards just a few corporations. Like, the money was going towards a few corporations. It was very, the government and corporations were working hand in hand. And then you have more or less pre-World War II, Hitler's Germany. They were doing the same thing, where it was just a few corporations, big wigs, working hand in hand with the government. Would you say that crony capitalism at its extreme would be considered fascism?
I call it economic fascism. In fact, if you Google my name and economic fascism, you'll find an article I wrote about it 30 years ago. And I call it economic fascism because you don't necessarily have a dictator. You can still have democracy and elections. There's no, you don't have to have anti-Semitism like the Nazis or any of that stuff. Even authoritarianism, you don't have to have a big military. But with the economic systems of Germany and Italy in the 1920s and 30s, was they allowed private property, unlike the Russians. The Russian socialism was the government takeover of industry. But the Nazi, by the way, stands for National Socialism. So the Nazis were socialists, but they called themselves National Socialists. The Russians called themselves International Socialists. But the Nazi version of socialism was, we're going to allow private property and private enterprise, but it's going to be very strictly controlled, regulated, and regimented by the state, so that whatever it does under the direction of the state. That's what economic fascism was. Now, the system we have in America today is kind of similar, isn't it? Because, yeah, we allow private enterprise, but we have so much regulation and government control that it really is fascism. There's a publication by the Competitive Enterprise Institute of Washington, D.C. comes out every year. It's called 10,000 Commandments. You just Google 10,000 Commandments, you'll find it. And it lists all the regulations by the federal government. They're imposed on American citizens and American businesses in particular. And there are something like 75,000 pages of small print of federal regulations that American businesses, thank God they're not all enforced, but we wouldn't have any business in America left if they were all enforced, if the government had enough money to enforce them all. But yeah, that's really very similar. And another thing that the German and Italian fascists did is since they considered these to be government enterprises, they call them government-sponsored enterprises. So when they went bankrupt, they bailed them out. So bailouts was a feature of German and Italian fascism in the early 20th century. And of course, you know, look at what we did after the crash of 08, with the bailouts of the big banks and the big insurance companies and others, and the airlines, for that matter. So we have elements, that's a good point that you made, elements of economic fascism. And my friend Bob Higgs calls our system participatory fascism, because we still vote, they still let us vote, but the economic system is basically economic fascism.
Now, I would say, about a year ago, and I don't remember when Jack Dorsey left Twitter, but I remember when Twitter, Facebook, they controlled information. They were the chokehold. Everything went everything went through them pretty much, because they managed to shut down newspapers like the New York Post. And you also had your government working with them, the FBI working with them. And I, in my opinion, you know, crony capitalism grew because of them. You know, look at how much Jeff Bezos made. Look at what happened. Microsoft, those guys, they went from having, I think 14 billion, I can't give you the exact number, to over 100 billion in wealth. So now here comes Elon Musk. Now, I know Elon Musk, he has the SpaceX program, and I don't know how much he works with the government on that one. But now that Elon Musk took over Twitter, what's your take on the fact that now there's going to be more, in my opinion, there's going to be more free speech? People are going to finally say things that they were not allowed to previously on Twitter. Is this going to just open up the floodgates? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I think it's a great thing. I think it's going to happen. There's going to be freer speech. I think what is also going to happen is the government is going to do everything it can to totally destroy Elon Musk, even more than they attacked Donald Trump. He's now target number one. Donald Trump is probably saying, phew, I think I've dodged that bullet. Now then, the mad dogs are going to go after Elon Musk because he wants to introduce free speech to America. And we can't have that. And so, that's a great thing, but we'll see. I'm optimistic about it. I think things are moving, and that people are waking up to what's been going on. I was a university economics professor for 41 years, so I observed these attacks on free speech in the universities for decades. But now they've all of a sudden become pervasive in all of society, not just some crazy people in the universities. So I'm optimistic that Elon Musk is going to succeed. He's a smart guy. He's got a lot of money, and it's a good thing that the cultural Marxists who run the government are panicking over it, and they're making fools of themselves in a lot of the things that they say, and they're coming out in the open as enemies of free speech. That's a good thing. They're not calling it hate speech. You know what he's putting on Twitter. They're having to admit they're against free speech. And, you know, this all comes from a sort of a radical communist of the 1960s named Herbert Marcuse, who wrote a popular essay in which he argued that only the oppressed in society deserve free speech. The oppressors should be silenced. And to him, the oppressors are basically white heterosexual males. They're the oppressor class. It's different than the classic Marxism, which was, you know, the capitalist class and the working class. This class is the oppressor class versus the oppressed, which they claim is just about everybody else. And so that's why you saw so many college students over the years shout down, riot, and scream and yell, set buildings on fire whenever a conservative would be invited to campus to give a talk. They thought they were taking the moral high road by destroying free speech on campus. And this is why they were brainwashed into this neo-Marxist idea. But now they don't have the excuse that this is about oppression, because Twitter is about everything. It's anybody can participate. And so they have to admit they're against free speech. There's no more taking the moral high road by opposing Elon Musk.
Well, I know that they questioned the danger to democracy to have him running Twitter, but they said nothing when Bezos took out, who made his hundreds of billions in Amazon. Now, you know, he took over the Washington Post. I found it a little bit ironic and hypocritical that they.
It is. They're banking on, there's an old economic concept called rational ignorance, and politicians always bank on that. It basically says that the average person spends most of his or her time acquiring information about how to get through school, how to do your job, how to raise your family, how to pay the bills. And we spend relatively little attention on public policy and so forth. And that allows the people who do pay attention to public policy to skew our understanding of reality. And so what little we do know is often false because they can give us false information. And, you know, we have little information to begin with because we're too busy making a living, raising a family. And that's the average person. I think the late Rush Limbaugh called them the low information voters on his radio show. But he had an old friend of mine was a mutual friend of Rush Limbaugh's. His name's Thomas Hazlett. He's an economist like me. And he was always Rush's economic earpiece. And I think Rush probably got that idea from Tom, my friend Tom, explaining rational ignorance to him, like I just did to you. It's a sort of a economics lingo there, rational ignorance.
So I've got one more question. I don't know how many questions Alan's got, but this is more or less my last question. So freedom itself, which we are obviously all, at least us three, are advocates for, freedom doesn't necessarily lead to morality. How dangerous is it, or how risky is it, to tie moral virtues or moral values to an economic system? Should you tie those two together, or should you keep those two separate from each other?
Well, the thing about free market that creates prosperity, that anybody, it makes it a lot easier to open up, to create a church, to grow a church, to preach the gospel, to teach about morality, and so forth. The alternative is government is your source of moral ideas. How preposterous is that? That's the alternative to a free society, is morality. You have people like Anthony Fauci saying, I am science. And you have people like Al Gore saying, I am morality. Otherwise, you know, that's the only alternative. It's either government or free human beings.
Well, we had a little bit of technical difficulty or malfunction, if you will. So that's why that interview got cut a little short. But regardless, we went a little longer than anticipated. But it was such a great conversation. And Tom said he had to be somewhere. So look, it's a Saturday. People are busy. You know, you got things to do. And we're thankful for the time that Tom spent with us. Great conversation. Alan, what did you think? Did you get any of your questions answered as far as economics, like the School of Economics and stuff? I think that's important to be able to break apart and understand.
Absolutely. Economics is a big part of freedom. Red China has, you could sit and say that Red China has some freedom because they have some capitalism, but, you know, I should have asked him if that would be considered crony capitalism. Actually, I would say it would be crony capitalism because it's under the centrally planned economy. And, we got to discuss all that about centrally planned. I'm glad you mentioned the part about Nazi Germany, and then he pointed out that Nazi Germany, the latter part of that word meant socialism, national socialism. You know, it grew out of the German Workers' Party. When Hitler joined, it was called the German Workers' Party. So they added the word National Socialist in front of it. So, you know, crony capitalism has, you know, it led to what happened with the pandemic in terms of, people who had small businesses, restaurants, you know, little stores, they were shut down. And Amazon reaped the benefits. I mean, Jeff Bezos became over $100 billion because everybody was at home and purchased online rather than go into the stores. And he made his billions at the expense, you know, that we're talking about amnesty. He made his billions in billions at the expense of small businesses.
It is wild to me. And we sort of discussed this a little bit. Everything does revolve around politics. You can demand freedom and freedom of speech or different things like that as long as it fits your political party and your political party's narratives. But the moment it jumps to the opposite side, I find it so hypocritical. Like, the hypocrisy is ridiculous. That there are so many hypocritical people where you can, just on Twitter, it's almost like people don't remember what, it's one thing to not remember what you write or that you say, but it's another thing to not remember what you believe. And that's why I think so many people get in trouble with things that they say, is that they're not really saying things that they truly believe. They're saying things that match up with their party. Like take, for instance, the Young Turks. The main guy, Sink, or however you say his name, like, people will post, like, you said this like 6 years ago, and now you're saying this today, and it's polar opposite. People are getting follows, they're getting they're getting people to follow them on Twitter, and their social media gurus or social media influencers, strictly because they toe the party line. But when you look at it, it's like they don't really believe in anything. There's nothing solid there. So it's just bizarre to me that people who were trumpeting, you know, the Bill of Rights when the pandemic hit, they were like, who needs the Bill of Rights? It's insanity.
Yeah, freedom is killing people. That's what they would say. While at the same time, the governments would force the sick to reside in, you know, in assisted living, memory care facilities. And literally that decision killed a lot of the elderly.
Right. And because it was a mayor or a governor that lined up with your political affiliation, you gave them a free pass. I don't understand how people can do that. And if somebody comes up to me and says, well, aren't you a Republican? Didn't you vote, you know, Abbott and stuff? I'm like, yeah, I did. And I gave him hell when he started shutting things down.
You did a documentary, didn't you, where you showed up at...
I wrote an open letter in the Epoch Times to Governor Abbott. That got a lot of play. I did a video based on that open letter. It's obvious. You and I are conservative, but we give the Republican Party a very hard time as well whenever they do stupid stuff that we don't agree with. I mean, Dan Crenshaw, you know, I like a lot of the things that he says and does, but man, when he starts doing stuff, screwing around, like with the red flag laws, we had an entire episode dedicated to more or less, why would Crenshaw go with the red flag laws and how unconstitutional those things are. You have to, before you start talking and tweeting, you have to first believe in something and understand what you believe. It doesn't mean that your viewpoints cannot change. They can, but they can't change strictly because your party affiliation or society has decided to change something. No one, I would say no one in their right mind, just regular people, would have said that there were more than two genders. Left or right, like Republican or Democrat. But now all of a sudden you've got a party line on the Democrat party line that's like, no, there's plenty of genders. And people will go with it. People will go with it because why?
I just saw a funny video where some lady in a mask was yelling at a conservative guy with a beard, and she said something about women with uteruses or people with uteruses or something, and he was like, "Hey, why are you calling me a guy? How do you know I don't have a uterus?" And she goes, "Well, do you have a uterus?" I go, "What if I have a uterus?" He goes, "Well, you could if you're trans." And he's like, "You see, this is what I'm talking about. You're insane. You know that I don't have a uterus, yet you're sitting there saying that I could, and you're going to respect, you know." I saw it on Instagram. It's pretty funny if you get a chance. I don't know the guy's name, but there's insanity that's going on right now.
We've normalized hypocrisy and we've made it okay, but now it's gone to the point where we normalize insanity. This whole world is insane. What did history look like, though? Was history insane? Who knows? But let's go back.
History was never like... I know that we had some crazy things that took place. People were illogical, but... Nothing like this. Not to the point where you have new political alignments taking place because traditional voters are now saying, there's no way in hell I'm going to vote for this guy, even though I've been a party member for years. I mean, you know, I keep looking at Tulsi Gabbard. You know, I remember that Tulsi, I was like, man, you know, she could end up causing problems for conservatives because, you know, she's real popular. But then, you know, we come to realize that she was a very sane woman. She did not, even though she was vice chairperson of the party. But even she was like going, wait a minute, I'm not going to go with this insanity. And now when you sit there and you say people like Biden and Fetterman are fine, they should ruled. Fetterman should be in the Senate. Biden should be president. The guy can't even talk. He can't complete a sentence. And same with Fetterman. And their doctors, the doctors and the journalists are rallying around them and saying, no, they're fine. They're fine. And, you know, before Musk took over Twitter, if you said anything about Biden's mental insanity, you would get a warning. You would get the same with Facebook. And the same thing with the whole COVID, the whole vaccine. Even though we're seeing people dying, dropping, young, healthy people dropping dead, they're rallying around what the government is saying. They're all, you know, working together. Things are going to change.
Yeah. And speaking of Fetterman, Meghan McCain, not my favorite person in the world for sure, she tweeted out something along the lines like, if you think Fetterman should be in the Senate, then you are a liar and a propagandist. And obviously the left came out against her and said, your dad would be ashamed of you. And then what about your dad when he was sick and with brain cancer and everything? You know, the left or the Democrats supported him. And it's like, look. If a guy has brain cancer and he's really struggling, he should drop out. He should say, look, I can't do my job. I agree with that. But that's a little bit of apples and oranges. You're already voted in. You're already a senator. You're already in. So it's sort of up to that person to get out. It's not up to the voters anymore. The person's already in. Now, constitutionally, you can have sort of a referendum within the Senate and say, look, how many people think this person should leave, should not be a part, then yeah, you can kick them out. But it's like that's apples and oranges to an extent. Doesn't mean that I think that he should have stayed in. I think, look, if you're that sick and if you're hardly going to be able to be in the Senate during the sessions, then yeah, you shouldn't be in there. You should, like, let somebody else get in there in your stead.
I'm going to make a prediction. You know how we made predictions? I did one on Musk. This is going to be my prediction. Joe Biden will not finish his term in office, but he will remain in office until after January 21st.
of this coming year or
2023 January. He will be in office January 21st. Now, whether he resigns that day, I don't know, but he will be in office January the 21st. The reason for that is if he stays in office, then if they are going to either get rid of, what's her name? She's such a loser, our vice president.
Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris. I don't know why some of these names, I can remember some names here, but I'll forget other names here, maybe because Kamala Harris is not someone I think about. But whether they keep Kamala Harris or they're going to pull a Wallace Truman switch around, they're gonna put somebody else, whoever is going to be the vice president at the time or whoever they're going to put in as president. I think Biden will be removed from office after January the 21st so that whoever becomes the president can not only finish that term but also run for two full terms afterwards. So in essence, could become president for just under 10 years, which is allowed under, what is it, the 25th Amendment? Is it the 25th Amendment?
Off the top of my head, I don't know, but it's...
I want to say it's the 25th. It could be the 26th. Whatever was put in place after Franklin Roosevelt was died, they were like, you know what? We don't want another president to... hold three terms of office. It should be 8 years or 10 if they take over. So that's going to be my prediction.
All right. Well, that's going to be an interesting prediction. We'll see what happens come January. That is in the future. Let's go to the past with This Week in History. All right. Well, my This Week in History is a very famous one, Veterans Day, as it is known, but November 11th, 1918. It was known as, I think, Armistice Day initially, but now it's Veterans Day. But that is when the armistice was signed, and that brought the hostilities to an end for World War I. And we've got a little bit, since we were talking about economics pretty much the entire time, this is a bit of an economist tie-in with, we mentioned him earlier, John Maynard Keynes. He was a British economist, was a witness to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. He was a representative of the British Treasury and was deputy for the Chancellor of the Exchequer. How do you say that?
I think it's the Exchequer.
Okay, Exchequer on the Supreme Economic Council. Now, he resigned from both positions. I liked the guy. I don't really agree with his economical position. But he resigned from both positions seeing how the conference was going. And he went on to write The Economic Consequences of the Peace, which predicted, speaking of predictions, my friend, he predicted there would be more tension and another war as a consequence of the unfair treaty, the Treaty of Versailles. There you go.
That's interesting. You know, I believe they used to also call it Remembrance Day. So you had Remembrance Day, Armistice Day, and Veterans Day.
There you go.
Which is different from Memorial Day. Veterans Day honors all vets. Memorial Day, the dead ones, those that deceased. Well, funny that you mentioned that one, because mine is also something that took place during the First World War, also known as the Great War. This took place on November the 9th of 1914. There was a naval battle in the Indian Ocean between the German cruiser SMS Emden and the Australian cruiser HMAS Sydney. Now, the SMS Emden, we'll just call him the Emden. The Emden was a commerce raider, and it was a Dresden-class cruiser. What does that mean? I don't know. Look it up. A lot of information there. But it had 10 primary guns, 105mm, which was about 4.1 inches, and it moved about 27 miles an hour. Now, they were in the harbor of Tsingtao, which at that time was a German possession in China, mainland China. But they were afraid that Japan was going to go to war on the side of the Allies, which they did, because Japan wanted parts of China. So they left. They were part of the East Asia Squadron, a fleet that most of them met their demise at the Falkland Islands. But they left and they went into the Indian Ocean and they just started attacking British shipping. They became really known as the terror of the Indian Ocean. But, you know, the captain, the men of the Emden were very honorable gentlemen, because when they captured someone or when they captured the enemy, they treated them very well. They were nothing like the Nazis. They, you know, the captain was considered a true gentleman who really followed the rules of war. You know, they attacked a lot of ships. They captured a lot of ships, took their possessions. They attacked Madras in India, Penang in Malaysia, modern-day Malaysia. They went to, now on November the 9th, they went to the Cocos Islands, also known as Keeling Island. It was a British possession. Now there, they sent out the wireless station sent out a transmission stating that an unknown ship is approaching. About 60 miles away was the HMAS Sydney. They were, you know, on patrols or escorting some ships. Now, the crew of the Emden thought that the ship was maybe about 250, 300 miles away. So I had plenty of time. We don't need to worry about them. So they sent some men to go about 60 men, 50 men, about, you know, let's just say about 50 men. They went on patrol to, you know, capture what they could from the islands, destroy the wireless station. But while they're there, the Sydney shows up. And the Emden blew their horn to get them, hey, get back. They didn't. So the Emden just took off because they were outgunned and by the Sydney. And there was a battle that took place. And about a third of the crew were killed on the Emden. They ended up having to beach themselves on North Keeling Island. It wasn't a very long battle. So everybody on there was either captured or killed. So now the guys that were left behind, they jumped on board a sailboat called the Aisha, and they had an adventure of their own, and they sailed off into what is now Indonesia. It was the Netherlands East Indies, and they made their way to Arabia, Turkish Arabia. And from there, Turkey was a ally of Germany. So they did manage to get home. It was really a pretty incredible adventure. If you get a chance, read about it. It's the Emden, the SMS Emden, that was destroyed on November the 9th of 1914.
Very interesting. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is This Week in History. All right, and to finalize the show, as we always do, book and movie recommendations. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm only hearing good things, although I am hearing that it is incredibly brutal as well. All Quiet on the Western Front, the new film. It is in German. It's got the subtitles, but it is supposed to be very good. And I am looking forward to watching it. I would like to watch it with you, Alan. We could do a review of it, but if I wait too long, I'm going to miss it in the theaters. So I may end up having to just go with somebody else or all by my lonesome. Either way is fine with me. That's my movie recommendation. My book recommendation is actually books. We had this guy on, I think it was last season. I know last year, maybe at the beginning of the year. Anyways, The Approaching Storm. This is all that was going on before America got involved in World War I. The book, The Guns of August, is about that more or less that first month of World War I, starting off in Europe in 1914, an incredible book we've mentioned numerous times on the show. And then Paris 1919, what happened after the war came to an end, and to an extent, how we have the world that we have today, and also why there was World War II. So fantastic book. Margaret Macmillan, love her work. Barbara Tuchman, also fantastic work. And Neil Langtell. So anyone who thinks that women don't get represented over here, hello, those are two female historians. Come on, go ahead.
You know, I really would like to go watch the movie with you. I remember how much fun we had watching Midway. And the unfortunate thing is that, you know, with my job, I've also got things going on that is just going to make it impossible for me to, you know, even take some time. I've got way too much on my plate. So I do apologize, but I'm just going to say go watch the movie. I hope you enjoy it. I hope it's a great movie. I hope it's not woked, if you know what I mean. Yeah, so okay, now for me, I want to recommend the book to the politically incorrect guide to economics. Now, did he say, is it out, or did he say that it's going to be coming out, or
it may already be out. I can check, but
well, you know, because I have read several. I don't read the politically incorrect guides by themselves. I read them as a supplement. So because, you know, you really do need to get, you know, more than one side's take on a subject. So but seeing how economics is, you know, especially with Paul Krugman being highly quoted all the time, and the guy seems to be, you know,
wrong all the time.
Help me out here. You know,
he's always wrong.
Krugman is wrong all the time. And I can't stand the guy. Just his demeanor when he's speaking. I can't stand the guy. But anyway, so get the politically incorrect guide to economics. I think it'd be worth it. Now, you know, as a supplement, I have a couple of Friedrich Hayek's books, The Constitution of Liberty and The Road to Serfdom. He's a member of the Austrian School, which is our guest is a member of that. Milton Friedman. Now, this is the Milton Friedman book I have, is Capitalism and Freedom. So it's a bestseller. But and then I know you probably, I don't know if you've heard of this, the Salamanca School. I'm trying not to get the lights on it. Are you familiar with them?
No, I'm not.
This one, this is a school in Spain, and they follow also the Austrian, they've been around a while, but they do follow the Austrian school of thought. So anyway, so there's a bunch of books for you there. Learn free market capitalism, stay away from crony capitalism, and stay away from socialism, Keynesian economics, whatever. Just, they've ruined the world. Okay. Movies. I'm going to mention a couple of them just for good old entertainment. Some toxic masculinity. I went as toxic masculinity for Halloween. I don't know if I told you that.
No, you didn't. That's a great costume.
I wore a cowboy hat, cowboy boots, and my NRA t-shirt. And people are like, who are you supposed to be? I was like, toxic masculinity. And if they were leftists, they're like, you know... peed in their pants. So yeah, I was, you know, I couldn't carry my sidearm because it was a lot of drinking, and I knew I would have, you know, drawn attention to myself with my NRA shirt. Anyway, so all right, Wild Geese, very very good movie. Came out in the 70s. You know, it's got Richard Burton, Roger Moore, Richard Harris, and Hardy Krueger. So yep. Great, great, great movie. And then the other one is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Wow, wow, wow.
Yeah. So, great cast, Clint Eastwood.
Love that movie. Yeah, that's a very good one. Lots of toxic masculinity. Good stuff. Can't beat it. Speaking of Milton Friedman, this is the one that I have, and I think Thomas had mentioned on the show, Free to Choose. Fantastic book. So if you're looking for that, that's what it looks like. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, that is it. We hope that you enjoyed the show. Do us a favor, make sure that you subscribe wherever you're listening, and tell your friends and family about us. And when it comes time for the Christmas break, We hope that you and your family just sit around the fireplace, maybe have some eggnog, and watch our show for hours on end. All right. Well, that's it. We'll talk to you later.